Welcome to How to Write Kai Papers, the podcast. I am Dr. Leonard Nacke, an associate professor at the Stratford School of Interaction Design and Business and the director of the HCI Games Group at the University of Waterloo in Canada. It is difficult to turn an exciting HCI research project into a successful Kai publication. This podcast is here to help you. This is episode 10, interview with Jacob Wobrock.
Hi, glad to be here. My name is Jacob Wobrock, and I'm a professor at the University of Washington in Seattle, in the state of Washington in the USA. And I'm a professor in the Information School at the University of Washington. And I'm also a professor in the Paul G. Allen School of Computer Science and Engineering. I have a courtesy appointment in that school as well. And I've been involved with Kai for many years, really since I started my PhD at Carnegie Mellon in 2001. Seems like a long time ago now. And gosh, over the years, I think I've reviewed for Kai almost every year since then. So for, I think, 19 out of the last 20 years, I've reviewed for Kai. I've been on the Kai program committee for papers as an AC maybe 4, 5, 6 times. I can't remember exactly. I was the workshops co-chair, I think, in 2010. So I've been part of the Kai committee. And yeah, I've just been involved with Kai all throughout my time. I was really fortunate to be inducted in the Kai Academy in 2019, which is a great honor for me. And I also had the Social Impact Award in 2017. So Kai is really my home community, and I'm very grateful to the colleagues and people I've gotten to know through Kai over many years.
Yeah, thank you so much. And yeah, dare I say that you definitely have a lot of admirers out there, and I'm always in awe when I see your CV and just see all the things that you've achieved in your life to this point. It's really quite amazing. Specifically, the Kai Academy is definitely a big kudos for that. So I'm obviously quite excited. Somebody like you that has done this for many years and really been involved in both sides of the coin. At some point you had to get started, and I think it was like maybe almost a decade ago that you started writing this little PDF on your website and in terms of guiding students on how to write these Kai papers. And that's where, I first heard of your name. And then I think one of my colleagues, David Flatler, I think he worked with you at some point as well. And so, yeah, I was definitely familiar with your work coming to be as a researcher in the Kai community as well. And so I just want to know, as a first question, what types of papers you think the Kai community wants after all these years in the community? What do you think Kai is looking for when a junior researcher comes first to this community and they have no clue what paper to write? What paper should they write as their first paper? Not as their last paper or the more advanced ones, but what would you recommend as a first paper for a junior Kai researcher?
That's a great question. As a first paper, one of the things I'll start by saying is that thank you for the compliments, but to encourage the junior researchers out there, I want them to know that my first full Kai paper, my first regular Kai paper, wasn't until the last year, or maybe second to last year, of my PhD program. I struggled to get papers into Kai. In fact, I think I was rejected 5, 6, 7 times before I got my first paper, which was published in 2006. I'd had some papers at WIST and ASSETS and a few other conferences before that, but somehow Kai was a very elusive target for me. But I kept at it, and it's important to recognize this is more of a journey than a destination. And so to all the junior researchers and PhD students who are starting out, I want to offer that story to encourage them that just because your first or second try doesn't work at Kai, don't give up and don't get discouraged. My first Kai paper was published in 2006, and it was one of the best papers that year. It's amazing to remember that there were only 3 best papers that year because there were only 380 total submissions to Kai in 2006. And now, of course, there are thousands. So it's really grown so amazingly fast. But yeah, so it's important to stay with it. As far as topics and things, boy, Kai is so diverse now in terms of intellectual coverage and the topics that it covers. It's really hard to recommend maybe one type of paper, but I do think that it's okay for students and for junior researchers and really for everybody to remember that science and invention, they progress sometimes in leaps and bounds, and it's always nice to try for some big idea paper, but it's also fine to do what frankly might be called incremental work. And I know that word incremental is sometimes almost treated as a bad word or something. Oh, it's an incremental contribution. I would really like to help people not feel like that's a bad word. Not everything is going to be the next breakthrough. Not everything is going to move the field in a tremendous distance, a tremendous way. But we make progress over time in science through the accumulation of knowledge over many contributions of sometimes smaller scale, sometimes bigger scale. So for me, the advice I would give is pick a project, especially as a first paper, that you feel excited about, you feel passionate about, you're interested in the outcome. You have a genuine question you want to know the answer to. You have a genuine desire for an innovation that you're trying to see if it can work for people. And just pursue it. And don't really worry if the reviewers might think it's incremental or revolutionary or something in between. Because we all progress the field through work at all of those levels. And I don't want incremental to be a bad word. It's the baseline of scientific progress.
Very interesting point, because some people actually say that they call it like N+1 kind of work, where you're doing these little increments. Is actually a very popular form of research published at CHI. And I do think it's an interesting take to say, do what you're passionate about. Many people that I talk to on the podcast and on the show are really very true to this, that it doesn't really matter what CHI wants, it matters what you want. And then, of course, the magic is fitting it into a form that CHI wants. So maybe let's talk a little bit about that. How do you dress it up? How do you dress up this idea that you're passionate about in a way that is digestible for CHI? If we're looking structurally, what recommendations would you have for a junior researcher? They've maybe written some papers, they know there's introduction methods in the middle somewhere, and then there's a discussion at the end. So familiar with the basic concept of a scientific paper, but what should they put a special regard in when it comes to writing that CHI paper? And I know that you know that because you've obviously written some of that down in your PDF and your advice.
Yeah, I was thinking about this before we talked today, and I really would center on three kind of structural points of advice, if I can just go through those. And I'll highlight them each first and then go back into them. One is the importance of the introduction. The second is the importance of what fiction writers would especially say, show, not tell. And then the third point is a bit of a process piece of advice, which I can share, which is how I set up and structure the going about the writing. So going back to the intro, I really do believe that most reviewers make up their mind about a paper mostly by the end of the intro. They've seen the title, the abstract, and the intro, and they have a judgment at that point. And hopefully they're not set in stone and they can still be moved one way or the other by the rest of the paper after all. But they do have actually a somewhat established opinion at the end of the introduction. And so the introduction is immensely important, and I doubt anyone would argue otherwise. The advice that I give, I can't take credit for. I take from primarily Scott Hudson, professor at Carnegie Mellon, who many people will have heard of. And I don't remember if he laid this out in quite so plain terms, or it was over time that in talking with him, I learned this. My own advisor, Brad Myers at Carnegie Mellon, also influenced my approach to introductions. But ultimately, it amounts to what I call the 5-point introduction. And this is laid out in a white paper on my website that you've mentioned and people can find. But ultimately, it amounts to these 5 points, which is, it's a bit formulaic, but it's formulaic for a reason. It works well. And I would encourage people to learn the formula. And then if they want to deviate from it, but deviate from a position of knowledge, not from a position of resistance or ignorance. So the 5 points are setting up the state of the world, something about the world as it is. That world could be in technology, in people, in behavior, but somehow there's some state or situation in the world. And then there's the big but, you know, the world is thus, but there's a problem, but there's an opportunity, but there's something not quite working, but there's things that have not been developed or explored. After the big but, then we can go into, you know, so therefore we did something about that, right? So the world is a certain way, but there's some issue or problem. Therefore, we did something. And then what were the key findings of having done that? So that's the fourth step. The key findings or the key outcomes from doing this are the following. And then finally ending that intro with the contributions, the knowledge contributions of the paper. I wrote a paper for Interactions magazine with Julie Keats in 2016 on the research contributions in HCI, where we identify that there are primarily about 7 different types of contribution, knowledge types, empirical knowledge, methodological knowledge, theoretical knowledge, an artifact or invention, which is its own form of knowledge, and a few other types. And those contributions can be really helpful in the reader understanding the type of knowledge that the paper contributes. So the state of the world, the big but, therefore we did the key findings are and the contributions are, makes for a really nice introduction structure. And it, as it happens, late fall, usually falls out to about a page or maybe just slightly over a page, which is about the right length. So that's the introduction. And I think nailing that motivation is really important. I would also then say, going to the second point of show, not tell, this is advice you hear a lot from fiction writers. Of course, they're only working with words. Generally, most fiction books, novels and things don't have figures, although some might have some illustrations. But the idea behind this, even in words, is showing what's happening, not just telling about it. And so in a scientific paper, I think we get to this by adopting a teaching stance towards the writing, that you're teaching the reader. Just like we might give a teaching moment in a classroom verbally, when we write, I think we can teach. So a lot of times authors write for themselves. They write for their frame of knowledge and what they know. But if we are user-centered designers, after all, we should be reader-centered writers, by analogy. So as we write, constantly thinking, what does the reader know at this point? How do I show them more? The use of figures, I think, is really important. And not having captions that are just a single little five-word sentence that makes sense to the writer, but actually explain what to look for in the figure that is important there. What to draw the reader's attention to. Why does that figure matter? What's it telling the reader? Those kinds of ways of showing what matters and what's important rather than just telling them from your own point of view, I think is very valuable. That first Chi paper I mentioned a few minutes ago that I got finally after many years of trying, I looked back at it yesterday, actually I was curious, and it has 19 figures. Now that's on the high end, I admit. And by the way, this is when there was a 10-page limit for Chi papers, including the references. And it's very illustrated well. And it refers a lot to the figures as the reader goes through. The writing refers to the figures and helps the reader understand from these visuals. And I just think that is a good thing to try to do. And I know it's a lot of work to make figures, especially good ones, but it's well worth the investment, I think. Finally, the third point is process-wise. This is just a really mechanical thing, and it's going to differ by person to person. But what I found that really works for me is I actually lay out my title, and then I go through and put in the header level one, and header level two, and maybe header level three, but that gets a little low level. But certainly header level ones and header level twos. So those kind of top section headings and then the subsection headings. And I just put those in with enough white space in between them in the actual template. And then what I go through and do is I put bullet points beneath all of those headings so that I know basically the main points I want to make in every single section. And then once I've done that for the whole paper, I go back to the intro and I just write through those bullet points. I think of it as a steamroller. I think it's the machine, those big heavy machines with the roller on the, in road construction crews. And they roll through and they just smooth out all the asphalt or cement to make it perfectly smooth. It's kind of like that. You have these bullet points and then you just steamroll right through them and you smooth them all out into nice writing. And I do that from beginning to end. And I think what's useful for me in that is then the paper takes on a coherent tone of voice and perspective from beginning to end, just as the reader will encounter it from beginning to end. And I know some people like to jump around and they'll write the discussion and then they'll go back and write the related work. For me, at least, that doesn't work too well because you end up with different voices, different perspectives. If you write non-linearly, then you have to ask yourself, will your reader read your paper non-linearly? Sometimes we jump around and look at figures and things, but most readers read from start to finish for a paper. And I think writing from start to finish actually gives you an advantage in thinking from the reader's point of view. So that's a kind of mechanical piece of advice, but it does work a lot for me quite well. And I would recommend people at least try that.
It's nice that you're saying that because it's in line with what we're teaching in this course as well as part of the exercises are to bullet point things out. And then often we don't actually have the time to do the steamroller, but I really love that analogy that later on the students can then take that and take those bullet points that are generated and really roll it out. I also find in my experience that it's nice for the bullet points specifically to involve the co-authors, and you might be working with an undergrad student or there might be other people in the team and everyone can throw into the bullet points, but then usually it's the lead author that kind of takes that steamroller approach, at least the first one, and then the senior authors come in and help smooth things over after that.
I agree. In fact, thank you for mentioning that, because the time for the co-authors to really have their voice strategically is in the making of those bullets. What are we saying in each section? And in fact, what are the sections to begin with? What are the headers? A lot of them are standard, intro, related work, etc. But sometimes different papers might have a different kind of heading structure. Certainly subsections might be different. So getting co-authors all involved in that stage is fantastic. I do the same thing. And then I agree, the first author should really, for the sake of consistency in voice and presentation, be the one to draft through those bullet points. But then all the other co-authors, when they get that draft, there should be no surprises because they know what the points were going to be made. So when they see what's there, they can expect what's there. And then it becomes a question of how well is it crafted, but not what is there in the first place. I think it's very important to separate what the paper's trying to say from how it's saying it and how well it's saying it. So if you establish the what level work is the bullet points and the headers and stuff. And that should be a collaborative thing with co-authors. How it's then said is a writing exercise that is often best done by the first author so that you can have a consistent presentation and voice. And then others can come in and of course, improve that through editing. I think what's difficult is when if you're presented with a, and I work with this with my students, if they present me with a bunch of writing, prose, full sentences and so on, but we're still working through the what to say, it gets hard to deal with because now I'm also dealing with how they said it. And it's better first to deal with what you're going to say, get that settled, and then work on how. Right. And so separating what from how, I think, is valuable.
I think that's fantastic advice. The what first and then how next. It's a great sequential approach. Now, I also have a question for you, and this is an individual question, obviously, tied to your success in terms of writing work that gets cited too, because we have people that get published at CHI. And that might be work that is missing that interestingness. Now, on your side of things, you're getting a lot of citations and constant citations, not just, you don't just have, I have a couple of hit papers that are pushing a lot of my citations, but you have a lot of papers that get a lot of people to read them. So the question really is that just about your writing style or is it maybe about your topic? And I just want you to hypothesize a little bit because obviously you might not know where this is coming from, but you might have a little bit of a hunch in terms of what makes that consistency. Is it the field or is it the writing? Is it maybe because you have a certain type of paper that you write and that gets cited? And if you look at your own work also, maybe emphasize what work do you think gets cited more and what work do you think gets cited less, just in terms of whether studies get cited more or reviews get cited more, this kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's a great and hard question. It's flattering as well, thank you. But let me just first say, I don't know, you know, exactly why. I will say that if I look at the papers that I've done that tend to get more citations, and I think this might be true for many other people too, papers making a methodological contribution, if they get seen and if the method seems useful, I think tend to get the most citations. Like if there's one category of contribution, and I'll refer again people to the contributions article I wrote for Interactions with Julie Kintz, they can find in 2016. Where we describe these and we analyze CHI papers for their different contribution types from CHI 2016, I think. It's interesting to see that breakdown. Most papers at CHI are empirical papers, so they're studies, essentially, of various kinds. And of course, that's a huge space, studies of many different things and many different approaches and qualitative, quantitative, all of that is still empirical work. But most papers at CHI are studies. The second most, I think, were artifacts, so invention-type papers that you might also see at places like WIST or UBComp or other conferences. But the methodology papers are a little bit fewer, and I think partly that's because it's hard to do a method in a single paper. Many methodology papers are improvements on methods. So we've taken, I'm just making this up, but we've taken participatory design and we've adapted it for children. Or we've taken participatory design as a method and we've added some other component to it or some other stage in its process or something. Those kinds of method papers, if the method catches on, can get cited quite a lot because people are saying, I'm doing this, right? This is how I'm doing the work. And I'm citing this method as evidence for how I went about it. So if we look at methods that have caught on and are quite popular, it'd be no surprise to see lots of citations for grounded theory, lots of citations for participatory design, lots of citations for even user-centered design, going back to some of the early work in the 80s. So I do think some of my method papers have caught on. End user elicitation is a method that mainly has been applied with gesture work to have participants help design gestures for systems, but it's also now been used for icon design and command line term design, command keyword design, and other things where you're eliciting an input from a user to bring about a certain kind of output. That paper has gotten cited over, I think, 1,200 times. That was from Kai 2009. I have some statistics work that essentially amounts to some methods and tools that have been cited almost 1,000 times as well. I have a gesture recognizer called the dollar recognizer, the $1 recognizer, that was from WIST 2007. It's not a Kai paper, but it did lead to some other papers, N-dollar, P-dollar, Q-dollar, this kind of dollar family of gesture recognizers. But they're simple and easy to implement, and as a result, they've been used a lot. That's an artifact contribution of a kind as well, but it's also a method because it's enabling people to do work with gesture recognition in a much easier way. So these tend to be the ones that have caught on the most. Now, I want to say again to the junior researchers who are looking how to improve their craft in writing Kai papers. None of these papers, when I set out to write them, did I have any sense that they would be cited a lot or catch on or be something people noticed. The idea that you could predict what's going to really land, I think, is very hard. Instead, I would say I had an interest and passion and a felt need myself. I was, for example, with my gesture recognition paper, I was struggling to implement gesture recognition with some of the established methods. They involved a lot more kind of machine learning or pattern matching or AI than I'd had exposure to. And I just thought there has to be a simpler way to do this in an effective way. So I was my own audience in a way to begin with that work. One of the things that my dean, Harry Bruce was his name, of the information school at the University of Washington said when I first started as a professor in 2006, he came to one of my intro courses on research for my PhD students there. And he said, remember that even though you're a researcher and maybe you're an engineer or a designer or a scholar or whatever term you might use for yourself, before all of those terms, before any of those identities, you're first and foremost an author, because it's only through your writing that you will open your professional doors. Every talk you give at a conference, it's because you wrote something first. Every grant that gets funded, it's because you submitted something in writing. Every keynote speech that you give, generally it's because you wrote something that got noticed first. Whatever you're doing in your scholarly and professional lives, most doors will be opened through your written expression. And so if we're first authors and then second all those other things, I think it's a good mindset, and it honors this work. Sometimes we have this attitude of the real work is in the invention or the study or the research, but then, oh, I've got to go write the paper, as if it's a sort of burden and a secondary kind of thing. But actually, it's the primary thing, because we could all do research, but if we don't communicate it effectively, then the world doesn't know. And it's ultimately not disseminating knowledge to anybody, because it's just sitting on the shelf. And so if we're going to do research, it's not just for ourselves, it's for the betterment of the community and the world. And so we need to be first class authors before anything else. I think that's a good mindset.
Yeah, I love that idea of the writing is essentially the key that opens the doors to everything else. A really good analogy there. Since we're coming to the end, I do want to ask you one more question about the other side of things in terms of how people are actually reviewing papers and how they're evaluating papers. Now, you've done this a lot, and you've even instructed a whole herd of reviewers as part of ACing and SCing and other jobs, where essentially somebody, and I always tell that to students in that course, that are sometimes completely flabbergasted that there's really some sort of hierarchy at the end where you have the main herders, the paper chairs, and then it all trickles down into this sort of pyramid of things. At the very end, you have the reviewers that are doing things, so that usually they understand that at the higher level, the paper chairs and ACs and so forth, they actually have their best interest at heart, but it's not always easy to communicate that to reviewers. So along those lines, how do we communicate to reviewers to evaluate papers? And as students that are writing papers that are also then becoming reviewers and have to look for that excellence, what should they be looking out for as they're reviewing papers?
Yeah, great question. And so important for the health of any scholarly community. I would say that I do think that it's true, which sometimes we hear, that some of the harshest reviewers and harshest critics tend to be the most junior grad students, or maybe like first or second year professors, those who are early in their career. I think there's various reasons for that. And this isn't about casting blame on folks. I think I went through a phase like that too. Part of it is that you've begun to learn enough of what to look for And sometimes that kind of reviewing mindset can take on a kind of gotcha mindset, a boogeyman mindset. I'm looking for the gotcha. I'm looking for the boogeyman. Where did they go wrong? Where did they make a mistake? And I think over time, with more maturity, we come to, instead of looking for the problems or the faults or flaws, we begin looking for the benefits or the strengths or the upsides of the work. And that doesn't mean we ignore something that's really truly a major problem, but it does mean that we're looking for the advantages of the work rather than looking for the downfall or the problems or the disadvantages of the work. So I would encourage reviewers, and I remind myself of this as I enter a review, what about this paper is valuable? Where does this paper bring value to the reader, to the community? What am I learning from this paper? Where's the new knowledge? When I'm done with this paper, how have I changed? How have I improved my understanding? Because if those answers are good, then the paper's brought value into my life and it's brought value into the community. On the other hand, if I reach the end of the paper and I haven't really learned anything, or it's been really a confusing journey from start to finish, I'm not quite sure what they did and why, then it's probably something that needs more work. But that's a different mindset, looking for the benefit, the upside, the strength, the value, than spending time looking for, oh, they did the statistics wrong, or they didn't describe this well enough, or there's some kind of gotcha that is really not necessarily undermining the whole paper. It's just maybe something to improve. And so as reviewers, we can still affirm the value of a piece of work and then say, but this part's unclear. Please make that more clear. Or you're missing a few citations that are important. Or I think your motivation could be strengthened. That doesn't mean the paper should be rejected, right? It can still just be improved in those ways. And so looking for the upside, looking for the value, I think is the right mindset. And not so much looking for the flaw or the gotcha, I think is a good, it's a point of maturity for reviewers to go through. And we all have to go through that and grow into that. But I think the senior researchers begin to see that over time. The other thing too is we've all just been rejected so many times, no matter how many papers you have and how good you are at this craft of writing papers and doing research, we all get more rejections than we get acceptances. Jamie Teevan is a Microsoft renowned researcher in information retrieval and other aspects of HCI and search. And she reminds students that Michael Jordan, the greatest basketball, I'll still say the greatest basketball player to ever play. Maybe some people want to say LeBron James is in there now too. We can leave that argument aside. But Michael Jordan missed more shots than he took, than he made. He missed more shots than he made, and he's the greatest ever. And we're going to miss more shots than we take, than we make. And that's okay. That's how it works. We have to look at rejection as part of the research process. It's not a failure of the research process. It's part of the research process. And as reviewers, we help people improve. We don't just try to keep them out. And I think that's a healthy mindset, both for us as authors and as reviewers.
Yeah, I tend to call it painful growth with my students. It's really a part, in a good scenario, at least, it is a part of growing and growing your own understanding of your own research. But it is painful at times because specifically with the changing educational systems and whatnot, not everyone is used to that kind of criticism and the bluntness that sometimes comes across in these things. And so maybe...
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask you about this bluntness slash fairness thing. Like, how do we actually ensure that there is some fairness in the judgment as well?
Yeah, I was going to say that it's important as authors who get rejections, and we all do, of course, that we remind our students and we remind ourselves that our work is not us as people. Our work is our work. And we put our time and effort into it. We put our heart and soul into it. So, of course, it's going to sting sometimes, but it's not who we are. It's not what we are as people. And if anyone is going to be a successful researcher, I insist they must learn to separate themselves from their work. They must. And they cannot take it personally, and they cannot treat a criticism of their work as a criticism of them, the person. And the sooner people can get to that point, the better they'll do and the better they'll feel. And I think their work will improve. And so that gets into some aspects of when people make their work their identity, then a criticism of their work is a criticism of their identity. We just can't do that. And it's not true to what the work is, right? God forbid a Kai paper is who I am as a person. A Kai paper is a Kai paper. And as great as they might be, they're not, you know, I'd like to think I'm more than a Kai paper in my personhood. So I just would want to encourage people for that. As far as the fairness question you asked, this to me is also a responsibility on the part of program committees and program chairs to reinforce these values in their program committee. It's important to maybe give the little speech before the reviewing starts and say, let's look at the upsides. Let's look at what we've been doing. Ken Hinckley, a researcher at Microsoft Research for many years, I think wrote a paper, I believe, for reviewing for mobile HCI. It might have been about in 2014 or something, 2013, about the importance of looking for the upside and what value does this work bring and that kind of thing. And I think that sets a really good example that senior researchers need to help these new and junior researchers understand this perspective of looking for value and fairness, of course, too. Blind review helps with that, but certain topics are favored over others. And we have to recognize that all work can have value. It doesn't mean all work does have value, right? It has to actually bring forth that value, but all work can have value. It all has the potential to have value. And as reviewers, we need to help bring out the full potential of whatever piece of work we're given. Sometimes that's possible in one review cycle. Other times it needs a few more iterations, and that's fine. But let's look at ourselves as value extractors, value enhancers as reviewers, as opposed to sort of critics. And that's not because I'm wishy-washy, let's all be nice to each other, isn't it? Let's all smile and hug, kumbaya. It's because I actually think it's better for the community. It's better for the health of the science. It's better for the health of the art. It's better for the health of the inventions that we create to do that. There's a lot of value in our community, and we need to work to bring that out in each other as best as we can.
I think those are wonderful closing words in terms of what should we be looking for. We should be looking for value in the things that we create, that we approach, but also in the things that others create. We should be a value-focused community and really try to look for the best of things. I think there's no time better than this time where we really want to focus on that with all the outside forces that are influencing the way that we live and work these days. It's important to look for the positive in life and in your work and everything. So like that.
Indeed, I agree.
Thank you very much for this interview.